Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Wednesdays are the day that you and I get to meet another woman who has experienced her own life, walking her own path in her own way. Today's guest is no different. I'm very pleased to introduce you to Vanessa Lee Hoffman. Vanessa Hoffman, thank you for joining us here on Mind Talk.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Now, Vanessa Lee Hoffman, I'm probably going to tell you something you already know. You've been a writer for most of your life, actually since you were a child, when you began to write short stories. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's correct. I started writing when I was 9 years old, just for my classes and just for fun. And then it just evolved into better things.
Into so much more. Vanessa, take us to your beginning. Where were you born? Tell us about the family in which you grew up.
Okay, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, at Baptist Hospital, where Elvis died. So kind of a famous hospital that's no longer there. It was torn down. I was born to Lydia and Austin Hoffman. And my father worked in as an advertising director at the Commercial Appeal, big newspaper there in Memphis. And then he opened up his own advertising agency and became the biggest, I would say, in the Mid-South area, retail advertising agency. So I got to learn a lot about business through him. About 9 years old also, that's whenever he opened up the business. So, you know, during dinners, I would hear everything about it. So I became pretty business-oriented, too. And that's what helped me to open up my travel agency. That was my first business venture on my own. And I also did copy for advertising, so I did a lot of writing there, too, and for pamphlets as well.
So it sounds like you grew up in an intact family. Dad was in business, knew a lot of people. It sounds like your life was absolutely idyllic. No problems, no challenges. You were just kind of tooling along, creating your own business and doing your thing, huh?
Yeah. Well, there's always, you know, some kind of turmoil in life, but I guess I didn't have that much. I loved my parents so much, and we did have such a nice life. So I feel blessed.
Tell us about opening up a travel agency. I mean, they're almost a dying breed nowadays, aren't they?
Yeah. Whenever I opened it up, it was almost a dying breed back then. I got in right at the very end.
Really?
And therefore, we couldn't continue it. Actually, my mother was a part of this also. I was the president. She was the vice president. We loved to travel. See, my father, going back to him again, he won a lot of trips. And I was fortunate enough to take them with my mother, and even he let me take a couple of my friends from time to time. He would win by advertising a certain amount on the stations during that year. They would give him wonderful free trips to different places all over the world, even Australia. And we were fortunate enough to have gone on these trips. And so it got in my blood, the travel bug. So then I decided I want to open this up because I have thought about it since I've been young as well, being a travel agent, opening up a travel agency. So I went full force and opened it up. And we started out small, so we became bigger and a little bit bigger. Then we came pretty big. Whenever I bought into the Travel Network, and that was a nationwide firm out of New York City, mm-hmm. or just outside. And then we opened up a franchise in the Walmart Supercenter. So that was really, really nice. And we started getting a lot of business, and we started paying ourselves back for our loans, which was quite a feat. But the only problem was then at that time that we were so excited and so confident about the future for the travel business, the airlines took away all the commission, put it down to 0%. So we said, well, you know, just to make commissions from cruise from cruises are not enough for all this high rent in the Walmart Supercenter. And then they wanted us to sign another 5-year lease as well. So we said, if we want to do this, we could just do this out of our house like people were starting to do then. So we closed it down there, and then we kind of tried to start it from the house. But then I eventually got more and more into the education because I was a teacher, and I kind of let the travel go. We just did the travel for our own fun.
Well, traveling for fun is not a bad job if you can get it. Let me ask you this. You were a youngster, and you were exposed to many different cultures, as you just described, by accompanying your dad on some of his trips. What do you think is the impact, just in general, of children being exposed to many different cultures early on? So many children aren't.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I feel so fortunate, as I said before. It's just such an enlightenment. And you don't have the prejudice. I don't have it at all. And I always wanted to bring the world together. And I know it's getting harder and harder, but I always wanted that because I just like the people in all the different countries and the different cultures. And that is why I went back to the University of Memphis and got my degree in Spanish and my minor in German as well as French. Because I just, whenever I traveled to a new country, I didn't want to speak English there. I wanted to speak their language and try to do it as best as I can function as a tourist there, not speaking English. And to me, that was just so much fun. And the people, especially the French, of course, they really enjoyed it.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting that so many Americans, when traveling overseas, sort of get annoyed when people don't speak English. So, I mean, you did something that was actually very valuable for you, but also really spoke to your respect for the people in the countries you travel to.
Yes, I think it's so important because even whenever they come over here, they try to speak English because, of course, we couldn't communicate with them. So they do their darnest trying to fit in here, and I think that we should do that as well whenever we go overseas. Even just a few words or even a sentence. Just try something, and I just believe in that.
Well, and again, you actually wound up teaching Spanish, German, French. I mean, so you really believe in learning the languages.
Yes, and it was so challenging for me, especially whenever I was majoring in Spanish and minoring in German. And I would have to read one book of each language during each week and reports on them. And that, to me, was the highlight of my college career.
The highlight or something or other. There came when you had a terrible car crash. When was that?
That was when I was 19 years old. Yes, and it was actually April 23rd, going on my second birthday now. I consider that my second birthday, April 23rd, because I came back to life.
What happened with that car crash?
Well, I was a passenger in a car, and actually I was, I'll tell you the whole story. I was in a band at that time. I was in the middle of my musical career. We had just played in New York. I just come back from London, seeing some people there with the record company, and I was doing some waitressing work. And so I actually called my boyfriend. Okay, first of all, off my apartment. It was a garage apartment in East Memphis, and it was flooded. So I had to stay with my boyfriend's mother's house out in Collierville, which was about 30 minutes away from where I was living in Memphis.
Okay.
And, yes, and so after I got off work at the restaurant, I called my boyfriend and I said, could you meet me here and then take me to your mother's house? I just want to get a bite to eat. And he always comes immediately. But this time he didn't. He said, I'm so tired, I'm going to bed. So I said, okay, I called my friend Tom. He's been my friend since we were in drama together at 14 years old at Theater Memphis. And he came over, and we eventually were invited over to a table where the people that I barely knew from the high school, they were a couple years younger than we were, invited us over, and we ended up just having an appetizer with them. And then they invited us over to a party that was just a couple blocks away. And so I said, well, okay, I don't want to be gone too late because I've got to get up early tomorrow to go to work. And we went over there, Tom, I can't remember anything about it, but Tom said that I had one beer. And then whenever it was time for me to go home, I decided there was some young boys there that could drive, I mean, of driving age. And they said, well, I had a brand new yellow Camaro. And they said, no, we'll take your Camaro and you ride with this boy. I don't want to mention his name, but
okay.
Anyway, so I got into Tom saying, she does, she's had one beer, she can drive. You don't need to drive her car. They said, no, we want to drive the car. So they wanted to drive my sports car. So I was with this boy, and he took me back through the penal place. I'm trying to think of the roads we went through, but it was an obscure way. And then we ended up going on the main road, which is Poplar Avenue. And they told me, the paramedic said, that he evidently was going about 80 miles an hour. And
oh,
then he
my.
Ran off the side of the road, hit a big tree. And therefore, I ended up spastic. And he was far better than I was, because he slammed on the tree on my side of the car. And if you had seen the pictures of the car, it was like one of those old driving education videos.
Sure.
Or pictures of what you don't want to happen to your children. And it's amazing that anybody survived that accident. But they took me to the first hospital, and I was in a coma for 10 or 12 days. And I remember slightly being transferred to another place, which happened to be the second hospital, by ambulance. And then I woke up in the ambulance. My memory was instilled, my coma was gone, and I ended up seeing two of my doctors that I had at St. Jude. I was also a cancer patient 2 years before. And they were right in front of me. And then I see St. Jude through the window, because this hospital is right by St. Jude. And I was so scared. I said, oh, my gosh, am I in St. Jude again? Do I have cancer again? And then they had just come to see how I was, and tell them that they, you know, wish the best for me. So then I ended up after that going to downstairs for a couple of days for my physical therapy sessions. And then my mother told the hospital, you know what, we can do better with this if we take her home, get her into the home environment, and then I'll take her here every day. And that's what we did for 6 weeks. Then I was released, and I had to wear a brace, and then eventually just tennis shoes, no heels whatsoever, and the rest is history.
Well, you had to learn how to walk and talk. You had to learn everything all over again.
I did. Yes, I had to go to occupational therapy because I was spinning the round balls into square holes.
Okay.
And I had to, you know, figure out in my mind what was I doing wrong. And every day going there for 6 weeks and learning how to walk, talk, how to cook, how to place the pegs in the correct holes, that really worked to my advantage. So it was worth it. I would spend like 3 hours a day there.
You know, it's extraordinary because this all happened when you were a teenager, and what you just kind of slid into the conversation a moment ago was that before this terrible car crash, you had been diagnosed with cancer, and so you dealt with that scare as well. How old
Yes.
were you when you were diagnosed with cancer?
15 years old.
That is so young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you and your family? That's like the one diagnosis nobody wants to get.
Oh, it was. You're gonna make me cry.
Take your time.
Oh, my mother and father.
Take your time.
They were just very upset about it.
Sure.
But we knew that I could get through it. And I did. It took a year and a half of treatment. See, I was in third stage. So at that time, they had four stages. And with the first stage, you would have chemotherapy for 6 months. Second stage, 12 months. Third stage, year and a half. And the fourth stage, it was 2 years. So I had 4 weeks of radiation. on my upper body, then a 4-week break, then 4 weeks on my lower body. And then after that, a few weeks later, the chemotherapy treatment started.
What kind of cancer were you diagnosed with?
It was Hodgkin's disease.
Hmm.
And luckily at that time, that was the most curable cancer. And, you know, the least curable was leukemia. And I had a lot of friends that were there that had leukemia and didn't make it.
Now, I know this is a difficult subject, and I hope it's okay to continue to talk about it for just a moment. You were 15 years old.
Yeah.
You had your whole life ahead of you, and at 15, you know, for a lot of 15-year-olds, there's just so much they are doing, there's so much they want to do, and their lives are about their friends and their family and just sort of having a good time. And I just can't imagine for you at 15 what that felt like, getting that diagnosis. Did you even understand what that meant when you received the diagnosis?
I did. Fortunately, the doctors at St. Jude were so optimistic, and they were just wonderful. They were giving me every hope, great percentages, and every time I went in, even for a consultation, they always had smiles on their face and were laughing, because I don't think I could have stood it if it were like a lot of depressed people and just negative people. But they were very positive, and I think St. Jude had, you know, of course, is totally responsible for my recovery in every way, not just the medicines, but also the way that they treated me.
You know, it speaks clearly, you're speaking so much to the impact of the emotional presentation and the emotional connection that you received at St. Jude. Vanessa, we're going to take a break in just a moment. And when we come back, I'd like for you just to tell us a little bit more about St. Jude. I know that you have a new book that has come out, and you've indicated that some of the proceeds will become a donation to St. Jude. So clearly St.
Yes.
Jude has meant, as you said, saved your life and continues to mean a great deal in your life.
Definitely.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk, and we will be back in just a moment. Vanessa, at 15, you received a cancer diagnosis. At 19, you were in a horrifying accident, and yet here you are as an adult, still with a commitment to doing what you can to support a hospital that, as you've said, saved your life in so many ways at the age of 15. We hear so much about St. Jude's. But, you know, for most of us, we see PSAs on television. Talk to us about why you still support St. Jude.
Well, they did everything for me. It was just amazing what they did. And never gave up hope. I mean, always said, oh, you can definitely get through this. And I would leave actually happier than I did whenever I came in. And I just had all of those fluids in me that was supposed to make you sick and everything. But with them and all of their laughter and their this positive energy, I always leave just feeling great. And then I tried to, instead of having the nausea come over me, I would try to have a nice meal, believe it or not. I know that's hard to believe, with my family afterwards, because I'd get through at about 6 o'clock. It would take like 2.5 hours. You know, I'm watching, I have the mute on, and this is funny, I have the St. Jude commercial on right now. But anyway, yeah, and one of the boys getting chemotherapy there. No, we would always go out to a nice restaurant, and I look forward to that, you know. And even though I might be a little bit sick, I would make myself eat, because if I didn't, for me anyway, it would do the reverse for me. It would make me sick. And once I started eating, and then like an hour after I ate, I almost felt like 100%. So I continued to do that strategy.
That's an amazing strategy. How did your friends respond to the news of your diagnosis?
Oh, my whole school at that time, the high school, they were just giving me all kinds of little presents. They would do artwork for me, give me banners. And whenever I was first diagnosed, that was in February of, I think, I don't know, 78 or something. And what happened was I had to go and have a surgery before I started any of the treatments. And they would come up to the hospital. As a matter of fact, I was going on a junior-senior prom. Even though I wasn't a junior, I was a sophomore. Somebody was on the football team that was a junior. He invited me to go to be his date. So, of course, I couldn't go. I was in the hospital. And he came and he saw me. And that was very sweet, very nice. And other friends came up. And then I didn't see them for a while because I was taking the radiation every single day. I would go down there, and I had to have a tutor. So during the first 4 weeks, I had the tutor. Then I had a four-week break, and I still had the tutor. And then I had one more session of four-week radiation treatments. I had the tutor again. So it was like 12 weeks whenever I had the tutor. And so that was it. So it was pretty much like the whole end of the year, I had a tutor. And then, of course, the next year I had the regular school because I was just having chemotherapy once a week. Every Friday after school I would go down there. And they just, my friends just really supported me during the whole time, more than anything. And I know you didn't ask me about this, but I'll tell you, during that first summer, whenever I was taking the chemotherapy creams, that's when they started, during the summer, I was working as an usherette at a baseball stadium. Huh. Baseball team was a AA baseball team, the Memphis Chicks, Chickasaw Indians, so that was the nickname for it. And that to me was just, that's what also got me through it, because I would go there every night whenever they were in town. And I would sweep the bases. We would take turns, you know, entertaining the crowd, sweeping the bases, maybe patting the pitcher on the behind with the broom, just doing things to make the audience laugh. And then I would seat the people in their seats too. And I would work at the visiting team's dugout side, so I got to meet a lot of baseball players too from visiting teams. And they were just so wonderful to me. As a matter of fact, I got letters from them sent to the ballpark saying that they had talked about me, and they heard that I was going through all of these treatments, and they wished that they send their best wishes and everything. And they were just so nice. They would come out of the locker room with bubble gum for me or candies or whatever. They were just trying to do whatever they could to help me through that I was going through.
You know, I think about the times when people get pretty challenging diagnoses, and the people around them, out of their own discomfort, maybe they don't know what to say, they don't know how they feel themselves, will not talk about it, will try to act like they don't know about it or it doesn't exist. And clearly what you are describing is the almost life-saving value of having people acknowledge what you were going through, be there for you, support you. it's just so critical, and I think it's important for folks to know that when somebody is going through an illness, that it is important to be there and to be present in that person's life.
It is. You need people by your side. You can't act like this. It's not happening, because it is happening, and this will help you get through it in a way that that it really becomes easy at times. Even sometimes your inner being forgets what you're going through because you know you're encountering so many nice people and nice situations. You're just not thinking pessimistically. Optimistic.
The other thing that I'm hearing is as people were giving you gifts, it's not like they were necessarily going out and spending hundreds or thousands of bubble gum, a piece of candy,
right.
But it was really the thought behind the gift that was
right.
So enriching for you.
Yes, and just how they looked at you, you know, and they were just so happy to give you that piece of bubble gum, you know.
It really sounds like you had amazing experiences. I mean, clearly very challenging experiences. On the other side of it, though, really emotionally enriching experiences that in both situations, in the cancer with the car crash, really helped you through.
Yes, and it just, I never take anything for granted, even if I never get in bad moods. I can't because, you know, I was given life 2 times. So how can I get in a bad mood? I'm happy every day. You have to be. You know, when you survive 2 times, you just don't take anything for granted.
And, you know, that's another piece I'm glad you brought up, because, again, so many people take their lives and their relationships and their existence, just assume that it will always be there, and don't treasure it the way it sounds like you do. And that's
right,
so
right.
Important to be able to treasure your life in each moment, because clearly, as you've described, you absolutely, honestly never know what the next moment will bring you.
You never know. You never know. You just have to say, well, I've lived my life to the fullest. Whatever happens, I've made the choices, the best choices for me. And seriously, right now, I wouldn't have done... lived my life in the past different than the way that I lived it, because even with the cancer, you know, even though it was hard, I still, even going through that, I still learned so much from going through that horrific time.
What would you say, as you look back on these two absolutely challenging, and that's a tiny word compared to what you've lived through, what would you say you've learned about yourself through these challenging experiences we've just been talking about?
That I can be strong. I'm a lot stronger than I ever thought I was, because you just have to. You just can't let it get the best of you, and you have to say, I will beat this. And on the other incident, I said, I will walk, I will talk. Because I wasn't even able to form words after my car accident. I didn't know. I was trying to form, you know, get my thoughts out into the open. That's what some of the nurses and the occupational therapists say, because I can't really remember too much when I first got out of the coma. But I didn't express myself well enough. I couldn't form the right sentences or words. So, but you just have to keep on keeping on. And finally, it worked. You've got to be persistent.
You know, I think about other experiences that folks have where they're unable to say out loud what is in their mind and their heart to say. And it's enormously frustrating, which I think you can attest to, because you kind of know that there's a difference between what you want to say and what's actually coming out of your mouth. Can you talk for a moment just about what that experience is like?
Yes, I mean, you you know, you're getting mad. You're getting not, you're kind of like acting like you're mad at the people for not understanding what you're trying to say, but you're mostly mad at yourself because you can't make it come out. And you have so much you want to ask, so much you want to say, and it just doesn't come out. But it finally does. You just have to be patient and go through the trials and the tribulations, and eventually your body says, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to start talking, to start thinking again in the correct way. So you just have to be patient.
And to those around folks who are having difficulty with saying what's in their head and their hearts, patience, compassion, those are two skills that need to be available to them as well, would you say?
Yes. I know it's hard to come by for a lot of times, but it's so important for everybody, even for the individual themselves, to be patient, and then for other people that are going through some hard times, because, you know, most times it does work out for it in a positive way. We just have to be positive and be patient.
So at the risk of repeating myself for probably, I don't know, the 100th time, the way the words and the thoughts that are in your mind can be entirely incredibly powerful, not only on your emotional well-being, but on your physical well-being as well. You spent time in the music industry. For those who are listening who might think that music would be the thing to do, what are some of your observations or recommendations?
For music?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I was another phase in my life where I got to meet some very, very interesting people, and I would never, ever say, oh, I wish I never made it, but I wish that I had never even done this, because from what I learned from that experience and the people that I met, I would never trade it for the world. And especially, it was during my chemotherapy treatments. I was playing in bands when I was a little bit older than 16, like late 16 years, and then into the 17. And I was playing at different contests and just different parties. And we just, most of all, have had band practice at just about every night, and keep my father up to all hours of the night. And then we would just have fun. We would go into recording studios, record demo tapes. We'd write songs, sometimes by ourselves, sometimes all together. And we formed quite a friendship between all of the members of the band. I would never, never trade that for anything.
Would you say that going into music as a career is easy or not so much?
Oh, it gets harder every single year, every single year. So whenever I was doing it, it was still very hard. Even being from Memphis, which was supposedly, you know, the music capital of the world with Elvis and everything, it was tough. Elvis was there, and he was a one of a kind, first off. And he was there at a time whenever I think the public needed something in his style. But then, you know, everybody started coming in, and everybody started being more and more like each other. And Memphis just didn't have the contacts that they used to, and the wherewithal to produce legends like they used to. As you can see, like, nobody's really come from Memphis lately, and most of them go to Nashville. Like, if you're born and raised in Memphis, you go to Nashville now to make it.
Interesting.
But we stayed there, and we played up in New York several times, in Greenwich Village and Times Square. We did a lot of demo tape, like recordings, like I said earlier. And I went to Pepperdine for a little bit, about a year, my freshman year, and I was 17. It was right after you know, my treatments and everything. And I actually started writing music and lyrics in the music trailer there, and the courting has to fit the lyrics too. So to me, that was a big challenge, and I enjoyed that. I would stay there till like midnight sometimes writing lyrics, and then trying to form words to fit the lyrics. And then I even began opera. They wanted me to get into opera. So I started singing opera in my with my vocal coach, but then I decided not to do that.
And at some point, I mean, you have clearly stated that writing was a part of your life from almost the beginning of your life. But at some point, you really turned your attentions back to writing in a more full way. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, whenever I got older. After all my college days, my teaching days, the travel agency days, whenever but during all those days, I was still writing term papers, thesis, advertising, commercials I was writing. But I never really wrote novels, even though I would write short stories, and then I would have tons and tons of ideas all over my bedroom that I have put in folders. Whenever my friend, who I met at the pier, the older man, and he started lying to me and to all the people around him, but at that time we didn't know that he was spouting off lies. When I heard all of what he was rambling on and on about, and eventually he died in my house, I decided that evening to start. I said, "This is it, Vanessa. You've got to write your book. You've had so many ideas in the past, so many, opportunities. Okay, so many opportunities to do this, and you've got to sit down and do it." And I started that night after he died.
That's interesting. In a little bit, I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit more about that story about him, because in fact, that gentleman who you met and ultimately brought to your home and cared for was much of the impetus for a recent book, award-winning book, I might add, that you've written entitled Treasure. So that's, it's so interesting as to where writers actually get their motivation, get their ideas for what they write. He was a tremendous impact for you on Treasure.
He was.
And he died in your home.
I'm sorry?
He died in your home.
He did. He was, he wanted to be in a home before, when he died, with family members, even though it wasn't his family. My mother was here, the dogs were in the house, and he got to just fall in love with one of my dogs, Monty. And he wanted to be in a family environment when he was dying. And I didn't know he was dying. He was in hospice at the end, and that's whenever I found out he was dying, whenever he finally told me. And they said that he was at the hospital at that point, and then he said, they came up to me and they said he said that he would prefer to be at your house whenever the end comes, which would be within the next couple of weeks.
Oh boy.
Is that okay with you? And I said, sure, certainly. So we brought his wheelchair along with the oxygen bag, and he just stayed up at night with Monty at his feet. And then finally he drifted off to sleep. He didn't get much sleep, but he still had his oxygen bag and his fluids going on. They would come in like every day to make sure he was okay, and that's how it ended. And actually, whenever he died, he said, go out and get a toilet. This is, I can't even use the John. And he could barely speak at that point because of the John, something happened to it. I had a plumber out and they didn't put it in the right way. So I had to call this plumber again. They said, you need to get another John quickly and we'll be out that night. So I went as fast as I can with my mother and I went up to the hardware store, got the John, came back. It was like not even 30 minutes. And whenever I came back, all of the, there were ambulances and fire trucks. It wasn't just one fire truck. And they were all around the house. And I knew what had happened.
Mm.
But I left the door unlocked and I gave him a phone. I said, if anything happens, just call 911. And he did. And he told the officials, you know, that he told us to go out and quickly and get him the toilet because the plumbers were coming that night.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he was dead. So I had to go to the hospital and, you know, identify him. And then I said, well, but I'm not a relative. So I gave them his brother's name, who I called that night. And I said, is there anything you need me to do, you know, with all of his
sure
fortune or whatever, anything that any property he might have, whatever. And so he said, sit down, please. And I said, oh, I'm sitting. What? And he says, everything he's told you has been a complete lie.
My
he
word.
He doesn't have anything.
Vanessa, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want you to let folks know how you actually even met this gentleman. And then I want to talk more about treasure. Folks, you're listening to Women's Wednesday. We'll be right back. So we've been talking about a gentleman who ultimately had a huge impact on your life. How exactly did you meet this fellow?
Well, one day after school, I was teaching a couple of years at this one school in St. Petersburg. That's why I moved down here. I just needed a break. It was near the end of the school year, and I'd been working super hard and went down to the pier. I want to see some water and just relax. Do I want to go to the Gulf side? I don't want to go to the pier side because they're both relatively close. It's just a few miles away from each place. And I said, well, I'm going to go downtown to the pier side. So I went to the little cafe. It's an open-air cafe. And then I started seeing some fishermen reeling in fish on the lines. And I just sat down there and just started listening to them talking to one another. Then I was just happened to be sitting by this gentleman that was just started going on and on about his life and everything that has happened to him and his daughters and his stepdaughters, and he had a whole range variety of characters, and his $525 million, his huge mansion and cattle ranch down near Bradenton down south. And just everything that had happened, even some of his ties to the Irish Mafia. So everybody kept coming back. We left, went home. We decided, well, you know, we want to come back and listen to him speak some more. And maybe in a couple of days, so we would say, yeah, let's do it. Maybe on Wednesday we'll come back. So we'd come back like every couple of days to hear more and more about his rantings and ravings. And then one day, you know, while I was sitting there, I found out that he had to go to the hospital, and I didn't know why. He wasn't going to be back there for a while, he said, a couple of weeks anyway. And so, you know, then I went up to see him in the hospital, and that's when I found out that he had cancer. And then, you know, the hospice asked me if he could come to the house, and that's exactly what happened. He ended up dying in the house, so...
Was it, I mean, this was clearly somebody you didn't know, quite frankly, from a hole in the wall. And over time, he wound up spending his last moments in your house. Was the fact of his cancer diagnosis, did that have an impact on your willingness to open up your home to him?
Well, I'm sure it did. And he was about 30 years my senior, too. And he was kind of like a father, too, a father figure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm sure it did, and I always want to do that. If somebody is so nice to you as that, he was not a bad person at all, and everybody knew him. He did have an apartment downtown too, And I would speak to the people there, you know, who were the landlord's foreman and everything. And he always paid his bills on time. He got a nice check, you know, from the Social Security, they said, and from the Veterans Hospital. He got some kind of a pension. And so I knew that he wasn't a kooky person, but he was kooky in the way that he could not stop with these lies. But he was a very, very smart person. It was unbelievable. Whenever he would sit down at the kitchen table and do crossword puzzles, I put his wheelchair there by the kitchen table and so he could do his crossword puzzle. He came up with everything. In just a few minutes, he had everything, all the blanks filled. He was so smart, and I guess that's why he used this, his intelligence to create this huge fable of his.
And, in fact, you've said that his story and your realization that his stories were, in fact, stories was one of the things that prompted you to approach Treasure. Tell us about Treasure.
Yeah, Treasure. Treasure, everybody has their own idea of what Treasure is, first off. Most people, it's money and jewels and power. And I think of my treasure as just life. So I had to have this as the title of the book, even though it's just a simple title, Treasure. It's so important to me because everybody has their own idea of what treasure is.
Exactly.
And Treasure, first off, is a political and psychological thriller. It's a trilogy, okay, all in one. It spans the globe. It begins involving twins who are separated at birth, okay? And it's Frank. That's his real name. It's Francis in the book and Kenneth. They're two people, twins. But in reality, it's really his split personality.
Interesting.
Frank's split personality. So, yeah, and she had one. One of the twins becomes super wealthy. The other remains poor through circumstances beyond his control. They both eventually become involved with underworld entities. That's what starts making the book become very suspenseful. Criminals, organized crime, radical religious groups, terrorist organizations, and even ISIS is involved in this.
You've got everybody in it.
I'm sorry?
You have everybody in this book.
Yeah, they all work together, which might, I know it's fiction, and fiction, you know, anything is real, but that could happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've even heard people talking about, you know, that they think that this like Italian mafia person is working with this person, might be a terrorist group. And I just had them all coming together, working as one for greed and power, but they always work apart in betrayal, revenge, murder. You know, you can't trust anybody, any of these entities. But, you know, if you think, they look like, they seem like they're great friends with each other, well, turn the page and then you realize they're not. But they always work together, you know, for their own greed and power, worldwide domination. But like I said, they always work apart in betrayal, revenge, murder, hatred. But everybody involved in this three-part novel of intrigue, they all want their idea of treasure. Few do survive to claim it. Whatever that treasure is, few survive.
It's a
page-turner.
It absolutely is. Now, in your... in Treasure, your characters have secrets, and some of them are pretty dangerous secrets. Is this based on any personal experiences?
Well, you know, it might be, because I've met so many people. I've even met a terrorist. I had a terrorist incident one time when I was in Morocco, whenever he acted like he was slitting his throat and he said, "Death to all Americans." And this was in the 80s. And I was leading a tour over there, and we were just beyond scared at that point. But that was the first time that I had to do with it in this part of the world. That I have a lot of this part of the world in this book. The second part of the book is called The Silk Road to Atlantis. And that traces a Silk Road, the old Silk Route, and it goes all the way down to the Mideast. And there's one political part of intrigue in this trilogy, but it does play a major role throughout, and even into the third book. And this is the abduction of Cynthia by her husband, Ty. Now, Ty is a leader of militants in Ireland, a leader of the IRA and also the Irish Mafia. But he's also in cahoots with terrorists. He wants to be the ruler of the world. And I'm sure we've all met people that have that idea.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this, Vanessa.
Yeah.
The book, it's a three-parter. It's not the clearly it's not the first time you've written. For folks listening who are perhaps aspiring writers, can you give them a couple of thoughts about how to approach just the process of writing?
Just keep on writing every day. As whenever you have that idea, when you have that feeling like things just are coming into your brain, sit down. Even if you're fixing dinner or whatever, even just write down a sentence, because then you can always get back to that, because otherwise you'll lose that, and that's be an award-winning book. And then whenever you have time, then you can go back and expand on it. But that one sentence or that one idea could be a make or break. And just never give up. Keep on going and going, and just turn what you've experienced in life into a fiction or even a nonfiction. And you can even expound on all of your experiences, which is what I've done. I always expound on it to make it even greater. And my next book is going to be the next one I have out is coming out next month. It's called Domestic Ransom. Then I have another book that will be out next year, and that's going to be my first nonfiction. So I'm looking forward to that one. That's about my adopted daughter.
Ah, wonderful. There are many people who suggest to budding writers that they need to write something every day. Would you agree with that advice?
Well, I think that for many people, it's a good idea. I keep them in the routine. You know, every day they have a certain, like a few minutes that they have to do this. I don't, however. What it happens to me is, it's at least, you know, a couple times a week, though, however, it comes into my mind. I start thinking, I don't know what, but I have this feeling, and I start coming up with these elaborate thoughts. And I said, Vanessa, you got to sit down. It's time. And then I just start writing. And I don't even know what I'm going to write about, but then it just starts flowing. And then that's just how, from my subconscious, it has to be from there.
And so for you, writing a couple of times a week, but really paying attention to sort of the inner you, pushing you to actually sit down and write is an important part of your process.
Yes, it is very important, because I know that I'm going to be writing something that's decent whenever I have that feeling that comes into my head. And I don't just sit down for a minute or two. I usually sit down for a couple of hours when that happens.
Let me ask you this. When you are writing and submitting your material to any number of venues for publication, it's not uncommon to get a whole bunch of rejections. What would you say to writers who are getting all those rejections?
Just keep on keeping on, like I say. Nowadays, I've been to so many conferences, and nowadays, many of the leaders in the industry are talking about how self-publishing is becoming the norm now, and that's what I'm doing. The first book I had out was through a small publishing company. And they were good. They did good. Some decent editing for me. However, I ended up doing all of the publicity events myself and calling everybody. So, therefore, you can either save money, have your own, your own ideas about how you want your book to look if you self-publish. And it does take a little bit more discipline that way. However, you can save some money, plus you can make the book go farther in my estimation. You can book whatever event you want, and you don't have to be under the thumb of the publishing company if you're not exactly confident of how it's going to work out with them.
That's interesting. Self-publishing is becoming the new norm.
Yes.
That's fascinating. Vanessa, how would people learn more about you and more about your books? Is there a website?
Yes, there is. and I'll spell my name out because I know it's rather hard. Just go www.vanessa, V-A-N-E-S-S-A, Lee, L-E-I-G-H, Hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N, .com.
Terrific. All right. Vanessa Lee Hoffman, all one word, .com is the website. Vanessa, I have to thank you so much for taking the time to share with us today your own personal story.
Well, thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed this hour. Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. And again, folks, that web address is V-A-N-E-S-S-A. LEIGHHOFFMAN.com. And the name of Vanessa's book that we've been discussing is Treasure. It is a trilogy, and as you've heard Vanessa say earlier in the program, a part of the proceeds is going to be donated to St. Jude's Hospital, a hospital that was so much a part of Vanessa's survival when she was diagnosed with cancer. Folks, I want to thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. The best way to be in touch, however, is by going through the website. And again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, I would like you to always remember, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.